We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both formerly with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
And morning.
Your mic's not working good morning. Either.
Hello? Morning. Hello.
I'm not seeing the light.
Oh, there it is. Okay, it's working now.
Hey, welcome.
Good morning.
I have some words for the microphones this morning, but the FCC won't let me say them. Uh-huh. All right, so plenty to cover, starting with a little update prior to Election Day on this coming Tuesday.
Yeah, Washington poll comes out occasionally. It's a poll that's run by KCTS, Channel 9, and various other PBS affiliates around the state. And did some polling on the election coming up, and really the only notable statewide result of that was the polling that was done on I-591 and I-594, the two competing gun control initiatives, one of which would require background checks at gun shows and otherwise close the loophole on felons and people with mental health histories being able to purchase firearms, and the other, which would prevent any kind of standard like that by saying that Washington State can't enact anything that's tougher than a federal standard, which will never, ever be enacted. So the good news for supporters of I-594, which is the pro background check initiative, is that it looks like it's going to pass easily. It's up by basically about 2/3 of the vote, and even stronger in the Puget Sound region, where it's at 73% of the vote. But I-591, which would basically cancel out I-594, and it's not entirely clear, it will have to be decided by the courts what happens if both of them pass, is narrowly ahead also in the state. It's very, very close. But the perplexing part of this is that it's nearly tied in the Puget Sound region also, with 43% in favor and 45% against, which suggests that as pro-594 people have charged, the reason the National Rifle Association put 591 in the ballot in the first place was simply to confuse people about which was the pro-background checks initiative. It certainly looks that way, because if you believe the math on this, some 20% of the electorate in the Puget Sound region is favoring both initiatives, which makes no sense at all if you actually understand what the initiatives are for. So to review once again on that, 591, no, 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 no. 594, absolutely yes. That's the one that would close the gun show loophole. A couple of other interesting things, perhaps for future elections, since we certainly don't expect our legislature to have the courage to enact on this. The Washington poll also asked statewide if people agreed or disagreed with the creation of a state income tax on wealthy households. Turns out 48.3% across the state are in favor of that, and only 42% are against it, which is a nearly 50% and very clearly more than a majority. So perhaps it's time for another go at an initiative to create a state income tax on the higher income earners. And then also statewide, the question was asked if people supported a $15 an hour minimum wage. And it turns out 48.2% are in favor of that, and 47.8% are against that. Statistically, it's a dead heat, a very narrow majority. But once again, it tells you that support for much higher income tax, or not, well, that too, but much higher minimum wage is not simply something that wild-eyed liberals in Seattle are supporting. There's solid support for it across the state.
All right. Well, moving across the state, it appears this week that there's several organizations that are trying to shut down the Columbia Generating Station.
Yeah, three environmental groups this week filed suit to shut down the Columbia Generating Station at Hanford. That's the only commercial nuclear plant that's still operating in Washington state. The three groups are Northwest Environmental Defense Center, Northwest Environmental Advocates, and Columbia Riverkeeper. They filed suit in Thurston County Superior Court against the Washington Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council, which issued the water pollution permit for the Columbia Generating Station in 2006. The Columbia Generating Station is run by Energy Northwest. These groups contend that the permit violates the Clean Water Act by allowing Energy Northwest to pour toxic chemicals and heavy metals into a stretch of the Columbia River that is home to one of the most productive salmon spawning grounds in the Northwest, perhaps the last remaining large spawning grounds for Chinook salmon in the Columbia River.
And is this the same regulatory body that Jerry Paulette was talking about in the 7:30 hour that's allowing tanks from Hanford to leak as well?
I don't know. I didn't hear his
because it seems like there's an awful lot of that kind of contamination going on out there.
There is, and there has been a lot of contamination from Hanford, particularly from those underground tanks. I know that environmental groups have been measuring contaminants in the Columbia for a long time, and it's been high for a long time. The council issued the permit for the Columbia Generating Station in spite of strong objections by the National Marine Fisheries Service. And the environmental groups are asking the court to have the permit revoked, which would mean the Columbia Generating Station would have to close down. So that's some good news.
All right. Also out this week, the WashDOT issued a new forecast on long-term traffic.
Yeah, the Washington Department of Transportation issued a new forecast on long-term traffic volume in the state. And for the first time, really, it forecasts a small short-term increase followed by a long-term decline, which is some very good realism coming from WashDOT. Every year in the past, WashDOT has issued a forecast that shows long-term increases, sometimes very sharp long-term increases in the number of vehicle miles that people will be driving in the state of Washington. And in the past, and if you look at the trend, the actual trend over the last 15 years, you'll see that traffic volumes have pretty much leveled off and remained mostly flat just over, not just since the recession. There was a small dip in 2008, but actually over the last 15 years or so, in spite of some very big population increases, especially in Western Washington. Now, that has some implications for transportation budget, provided the legislature can actually pass one. The state transportation budget relies on the gas tax. And when people are driving less, they're using more gas. That means less gas tax revenue for the transportation budget. But also, it has some very big implications for the state's bonding capacity for transportation projects. Now, because WashDOT's been relying on a forecast that says, well, people are going to drive more miles in the future, they've been very, very liberal with their bonding capacity, which means they've been issuing lots and lots of bonds for very big construction projects, particularly for highway construction projects, on the assumption that they're going to have a certain amount of gas tax revenue in the future to pay off those bonds, to pay the interest, debt service on the bonds, and to pay off the principal on those bonds.
Things like the waterfront tunnel.
Yeah, exactly. And because they've been projecting those big increases in traffic volume and those big increases have not been appearing for the last 15 years, they've overestimated their bonding capacity. And so as of today, about half of the gas tax revenue in the transportation budget goes for debt service. That's an amazing amount. And WashDOT is predicting that within a few years, 3/4 of the gas tax revenue is going to go for debt service. So that means that the state's going to have to stop issuing bonds for these really big highway projects, especially now that the DOT is finally saying, oh, look, people are going to be driving less in the future.
All right. Also out this week, stories about the FBI and the Seattle Times.
Yeah, this was something that actually made the editorial page of the New York Times this morning. The Electronic Freedom Foundation revealed, and then the Seattle office of the FBI confirmed, that in 2007 the FBI faked an AP story link in Seattle, presumably through the Seattle Times, although the FBI has not confirmed that part, and then sent it to a 15-year-old suspect's MySpace page to lure him into opening the article. The suspect in a series of bomb threats in Thurston County opened the article. In fact, it then downloaded law enforcement malware that revealed his location and IP address to agents that were investigating threats that had led to several evacuations at Timberline High School in Lacey. Now, there are several notable things about this story, not the least of which is why in 2007 any 15-year-old was still reading MySpace, but above and beyond that, And of course, also that it's entirely credible because people are used to clickbait type totally invented stories in the Seattle Times. Hey, here's one weird trick for appealing the death tax. Above and beyond that, the FBI basically faking journalism stories in order to get the behavior that it wants from a member of the public is a very, very slippery slope, and one that is probably constitutionally very dubious. But the FBI's Seattle office says that it went through the national office. Remember, this is during the Bush administration, the final year of that. And they okayed the tactic. And in fact, during the Obama administration over the past several years, indications are that that type of violation of privacy and the public trust has probably become more routine rather than less routine. The lawsuit that's inevitably resulting from this is going to quite possibly turn up some very interesting and disturbing practices from the FBI and other law enforcement officials regarding what may or may not be true with what you're reading on the internet.
So just part of the big war on journalists and journalism.
And also public credibility.
Hmm. All right. Moving on, open enrollment about to start up again for health insurance.
Yeah, the open enrollment period for going on the state and federal health care exchanges to get insurance or to change your insurance will be November 15th through February 15th. And because that's coming up, there have been some questions from people. You know, have the numbers of uninsured Americans actually fallen because of the Affordable Care Act and the health insurance exchanges? And in fact, yes, the studies are in. The number of uninsured Americans have fallen by 25% just in the first year of the Affordable Care Act. That's a total of about 8 to 11 million people, plus an additional about 3 to 4 million younger people who have started in the job market and gained health insurance. That means that the total number of uninsured people in America have dropped from about 18% in early 2013 to about 13.4% by the end of May of this year. That's from 54 million people down to about 40 million people. So yeah. The question kind of remains, who are those remaining 40 million people? Most of them, of course, are people who live in states with Republican governors who chose not to expand Medicaid. People who were not poor enough to previously qualify for Medicaid, but are now too poor to be covered by subsidies in the healthcare exchanges, because when they log on and go through the process, it tells them that they shouldn't be getting subsidies. They should just file for Medicaid. But because their state governors didn't opt for it, they're kind of screwed. They fall into what's called the gap. Now, a lot of people who've fallen into the gap, about half of those people, live in only three states, Texas, Georgia, and Florida. Lots of low-income people live in Texas and Georgia, for example. And in Florida, they just have a very, very big population and a very conservative governor. Now, the good news, though, is that more than half of the 23 holdout states who haven't expanded Medicare are considering moving towards expanding Medicare. And that's primarily because hospitals have been pressuring them to do it. Hospitals who have been overburdened with care for people who don't have any insurance coverage and are not covered by Medicaid. So that's the good news. And if you take those two into account, that means within a couple of years, we'll probably see that 40 million dwindle down to just a very few million people. Of course, because we didn't opt for universal health care, that means there will always be some people who are not covered, particularly the homeless, people who don't have citizenship status, and folks maybe who are mentally ill and probably can't tell you what their name is, much less whether or not they have insurance through a healthcare exchange. So, because we didn't opt for universal health care, there'll always be a very small number of people that we don't treat as fully human.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's that small a number. But the other piece of that in terms of the good news, though, is that as of Tuesday, the state of Florida may no longer have a Republican governor.
Yes.
So that may change
that
the equation as well.
That's also a possibility.
All right. Update on Ebola here in the U.S.
Oh, yeah. No, this has been the big thing in the news is the Ebola quarantine in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and now also Illinois. We've been hearing about Casey Hickox, the one of the returning medical care workers who have been treating people with Ebola in West Africa, who came back and was detained at the Newark International Airport because Governor Christie, as well as New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and the governors of Illinois and Connecticut, had imposed a mandatory quarantine on all returning healthcare workers from West Africa. She was detained for hours in the airport with no food. She was then transported to an unheated tent outside of a New Jersey hospital and told that she had to stay there in permanent quarantine for 21 days until they could determine that she absolutely was not going to come down with Ebola. She got a lawyer, which was a smart move. And the organization that she worked for, Doctors Without Borders, kicked up a fuss, and the Obama administration stepped in because she contacted a friend at the Dallas Morning News, and together they wrote an editorial saying this is unacceptable. She was not ill. She had no symptoms and therefore could not spread a disease she doesn't have, and her civil rights were being violated. As of midweek, Governor Christie backpedaled on his quarantine, saying, well, she can go home and stay at home and self-quarantine. So he released her and let her go back to Maine, which is where she lives. And she promptly turned around and said, okay, now that I'm home, I'm going for a bike ride. And she broke quarantine and then was up before a judge.
And the reactionary governor of her state had a cow.
Had a cow, yeah. And then she was brought up before a judge. Well, the main judge saw some sense, and he said no, she does not have to remain in a quarantine as long as she doesn't have any symptoms, but she does have to check in with healthcare workers here in the States every day. She has to take her temperature, and if she does come down with symptoms, then she'll have to be in quarantine. So some sense there from a judge. And of course, then the CDC, prompted by the Obama administration, issued some guidelines saying that these returning medical care workers should not have to be subject to mandatory quarantine, that they can do what the judge told Casey Hickox she can do. So that's a little bit of good news. But, you know, it really points out the hysteria that's happening, and it's not just on the right here. You know, Andrew Cuomo is a Democratic governor. He's not a Republican. So the fact that he said, "I'm protecting the people of my state by putting unsymptomatic people who do not have the disease into quarantine," that's crazy. And I should also point out too that the state of Connecticut has so far quarantined about 9 people who don't have symptoms, who have returned from West Africa, and those people should be released immediately.
All right, moving on. Update on mail surveillance.
Yeah, the New York Times did a report this week on mail surveillance. Apparently, the U.S. Postal Service has approved, just in 2013, approved 50,000 requests from law enforcement agencies to monitor the mail of Americans. Only 8,000 of those requests were for criminal reasons, for criminal investigations. 42,000 were for national security investigations. That's 84% of the total. Now, a Postal Service audit that was done on the quiet and never really released formally to the public showed that many times the U.S. Postal Service approves these requests without asking the reason from the law enforcement agency or getting the proper documentation, which shows that just about anybody could be having their mail monitored, and the U.S. Postal Service is not keeping track of any particular reasons why, not asking for a warrant or anything. Also, the U.S. Postal Service uses a mail imaging program, which they've been using for years now, which photographs all the outside of your envelope and packages to show the to address and the from address on every single piece of mail in the entire postal system. That's bulk collection of data. Yes, it is. And that they provide that openly to law enforcement agencies that request information from that bulk collection of data. So that's just something folks ought to keep in mind. that it isn't just your cell phone or your email.
And I actually was kind of surprised in this that there are actually 50,000 pieces of individual mail that are mailed to and from individual people left in the entire postal system.
Oh, there's a lot of mail that still circulates, particularly packages.
Yes, that's true.
All right. Well, sticking with the news out of the New York Times, a report out this week about the Nazis and the CIA and...
A report that the CIA and other U.S. agencies employed at least 1,000 different former Nazis as Cold War spies and informants, and as recently as the 1990s, which is to say about 15 years ago, concealed the government's ties to some former Nazis war criminals living in the United States. This is something that in the context of competing with Stalin's Soviet Union in the post-war years for these German agents, the U.S. saw not just the value of having the intelligence experience of the German operatives, but also keeping that experience and knowledge out of Soviet hands. At the same time, in its justification for doing this, there are two important things happen. One, the justification that the CIA gave for employing these people often involved the severe downplaying of what they had done during the National Socialist regime in Germany. You had some very high-ranking officials in the German SS, for example, that had their crimes soft-pedaled by the CIA and these other agencies in order to justify relocating their families to the United States, etc. The second thing that happened is that really infused the culture. At one point in the early 1950s, it was estimated as a result of these releases this week that one in five CIA staff people were former Nazi war criminals. That that's kind of a staggering statistic to think about, and it also really infused the entire agency and the entire intelligence apparatus of the United States post-war with a certain ideology and with a certain worldview of how it looks at, for example, developing countries and the regimes of developing countries and respecting the democratic process that has really led to a type of foreign policy that has continued in the United States and an attitude toward war and intervention and covert operations in other countries that has continued over the past 70 years. Very long-term implications. This is not simply a historical story, but something whose impact continues in U.S. foreign policy, I think, to this day, long after the Cold War itself has gone away.
Yeah.
All right. Also this week, big protests in Burkina Faso.
Yeah, Burkina Faso, which used to be called Upper Volta, now called Burkina Faso, saw some very massive and in some cases violent protests this week. The president of Burkina Faso, who has been ruling the country for almost an entire generation, about 27 years, has been attempting to get national law changed so that he can continue to rule. And the people of Burkina Faso have decided that they would much rather burn down the parliament building and take control of the national radio and TV stations rather than let that happen. Blaise Compaoré, the president for the past 27 years, is a very good and close friend of France, which is the former imperialist nation that used to govern Burkina Faso when it was Upper Volta. They like him because he's a very good partner in the war on terrorism. So some very interesting vestiges of colonialism there.
Yeah, and a very key area also in the Western Sahara and the interior of West Africa, near Mali, near some of these other areas, southern Libya and so forth, that have seen a lot of Islamic terrorism. Northern Nigeria is also not too far away.
I wouldn't necessarily call all of it Islamic terrorism. Sometimes
not at all.
Sometimes it's a push to try to get minority rights. You also have to keep in You also have to keep in mind, too, that a lot of these governments that have had these long-term dictators are also military dictatorships. And in a lot of cases, people would really, really like to see some more political freedoms there.
Yeah. And where I was going with that is the United States also has an extremely large military presence in that region because of the war on terror.
And France has a very large base in Burkina Faso as well.
A lot of what's going on there is, as you mentioned, not particularly related to, and in fact predates the war on terror, and also has to do with post-colonial politics, resource extraction, arms sales, and a number of other way less savory rationales.
All right. And finally, some interesting words coming out this week from the Pope.
Yeah, Pope Francis causing wingnut heads to explode this week by coming out and saying that, actually the evolution and the Big Bang Theory are correct and don't contradict the role of a divine creator, according to the Catholic Church, but in fact require the presence of a divine creator. This from, according to Catholic theology, the inerrant Word of God. How people who have been not necessarily Catholics themselves, but evangelical Christians in this country in particular, but who have heavily relied on the authority of the Catholic Church to sort of buttress their idea that evolution is a hoax, et cetera, really having difficulty with that this week and saying, well, maybe the Pope is fallible after all, and maybe he doesn't really know what he's talking about because, you know, he's a foreigner and all that kind of it's remarkable the contortions people are going through in order to justify anti-science views in this country, but it does in fact continue to happen. And good to see on a global scale that the Catholic Church, one of the last vestiges of resisting scientific views, is willing to go with that now.
All right. Events.
Several coming up. Tuesday, of course, the deadline for ballots for the election we keep talking about. And as we've mentioned the last couple of weeks when we were going through the endorsements, those are available online for people who still haven't mailed in their ballots. They're available at gov.org, GEOV.org. Also on Tuesday from noon to 1:30 p.m., the Rise Up for Homeless Youth Benefit Luncheon for the Roots Young Adult Shelter in the U District that will be happening at the UW's Student Union Hub building, the North Ballroom there. And then Tuesday evening at Town Hall is a good event, too.
Ebola Facts and Fiction at Town Hall, 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday the 4th. That's at 7th and Seneca. It's sponsored by the Washington Global Health and Code Med. Go and find out what Ebola is all about and how it spreads and what it's doing to West Africa.